Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hannah Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we will speak about climate security in Somalia and its broader relevance in the UN system together with Christoph Hodder, member of the Climate Security Expert Network. If you are a climate security geek, just like us, you definitely heard of Chris. He's the first United Nations climate security and environmental advisor to Somalia, where he works to implement the UN's mandate on environment and security. We would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. Welcome, Chris. We're thrilled you're joining us today.
Thank you. And it's really great to be here. So very happy to speak to you. Looking forward to it.
Before we get into the issue of today, let's take a closer look at Somalia. What would you say our listeners need to know about the country? I bet there are important socioeconomic, security, geographic, and historic aspects that are crucial to understand the country today, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Somalia is a fascinating country. It has the longest coastline in the whole of Africa, and it used to be, and it still is, such a beautiful country in terms of its environmental and its ability and economic drive. And Somalis are around the world and are very driven. There's a huge diaspora and very entrepreneurial spirit. So historically, Somalia, after the colonialism and the war, and it's split into sort of several different states. Currently, you have the Somaliland in the sort of northwest, and then you have Somalia, the greater Somalia, to the sort of east. And then Somalia itself used to export bananas. It used to have a very thriving economy, but unfortunately, a lot of that broke down. And so there is a lot of clan and sort of group dynamics that happened between different states and different areas. And then there was the Barre regime in the 1990s was actually quite a successful regime. And there was a lot of infrastructure work going on in the beginning and a lot of exports. And it was Mogadishu itself was quite a thriving city. And it is still today. But what happened was that then it descended into civil war and the sort of clan dynamics continued to become much more involved and complicated. And then on top of that, there were different extremist groups, the militant groups that sort of took control of certain areas. And Al-Shabaab, ISIS, ISIS, there are quite a few different militant groups aligned with different backgrounds, different agendas. And so really at the moment, what we have is we have these sort of inter-clan dynamics and conflicts that were getting better over the years. And with the federal government and the transitional government, there has actually been, over the last 5-10 years, there's actually been quite a good sort of step towards internationally recognized sort of governance systems. And then they reached their HIPIC status a couple of years ago, so allowing for World Bank funding. And so there is good trends moving towards the right directions. However, there still remains militant group and different militant groups are still controlling quite large areas in the country. And so that's why there are UN and AU peacekeeping forces on the ground. And yeah, that's why I'm here. And this is part of, I'm seconded from UNIF to be part of the UN political, special political mission to Somalia to try to help in the transition, the work around the politics and the support around Somalia. And Somalia is in the process of going through an election right now. And we really hope that in the next couple of months, we will have a recognized parliament and a recognized prime minister and president as well. So hopefully there's some great opportunities to go forward, but it is a complex environment around different personal dynamics. There's a lot of economic issues, and then there's a lot of issues around the environment as well. I know we're going to come to that in a minute.
Thanks, Christopher. Hi, also from my side. Yeah, as you outlined, the social insecurity situation in Somalia, it's complicated to say the least. And on top of all this comes climate change and environmental impacts. What would you say that this means for the different actors and for these different dynamics that you just explained? How does this come on top of this and how does it change things?
Yeah, absolutely. And good to see you, Michael, as well. Basically, what we're seeing now is that climate change is exacerbating some of these tensions. And so I was outlining that the clan sort of dynamics and Somalian clan dynamics is quite complicated. And so in certain areas, you would have some clans that would work together, and in other areas, the same clans would be conflicting. So there's a complexity in the whole dynamics around it. But what we're seeing is that climate change is exacerbating a lot of these conflicts. And these are inter-clan, intra-clan, and then also between state or recognized federal security approaches and militant groups. All of those sort of complex dynamics are exacerbated by climate change. And so when we talk about climate security, we don't make the direct link between climate and conflict. We can't say there's any direct empirical link. But more and more now, what we can say is that it is a driving exacerbator or a sort of multiplier. And what we're seeing on the ground actually is that there are these sort of links between climate and conflict. And one of them, the first one, is really around livelihoods. And so in Somalia, the breadbasket around the two rivers is the agricultural lands. And then the sort of central and northern areas are more dry and arid. Those are traditionally the sort of livestock routes. And that's the herders and the camel raisers and the trading commercial. And so traditionally, Somalia was something like 70% was livestock as their main GDP and output were, but now it's definitely changing because climate change. So what we're seeing is in this livelihood or livelihoods link between climate and conflict is that because there's the rise in temperatures and because there's less access to water, the herders have to go further or they can't move along the traditional routes anymore because there's no water or there's no grazing. And so what we can see in specific conflicts, and I can give you an example of an area in Mataban where we can definitely see the dynamics changing based on whether there's too much water with the flooding or there's not enough water in the drought season. So, and what we can see overall is that Somalia, the fluctuations that used to be every 10 years that we would have a drought, but now we're seeing it actually almost every other year there is this drought, and now we're seeing a drought flooding cycle. So that's what we call the extremities of water. And that's really definitely making a big impact on populations. So that's the first area that climate change is looking. The second one is really around displacement. And currently with the drought, we have something like 7 million people in need of humanitarian aid. And we have something like 3.4 million people displaced in Somalia and with rising numbers because of the droughts. And people are being displaced mainly because of these climatic events, so flooding or droughts. And what we're seeing, though, is that people move and then they have maladaptation techniques because they need to have charcoal to cook. And so they chop down trees and contribute to the charcoal trade because they need trees to survive, the charcoal to survive, to cook on and for heat. And what we're seeing is actually the displacement is then causing further displacement because it then causes people have to move to areas that are already environmentally unstable. And then with the tree cutting down and the clearing of the bush, they also then contribute to soil erosion, which then contributes further to deforestation, which contributes further to increases in temperature. And it means that they'll have to probably likely have to displace again. So there's a big cycle there between temperature rise, deforestation, displacement. And those people that displace often then have to go onto land an area where there are other people around. And then you bring into conflict, further conflict, these sort of dynamics between people who move and host communities. So that's the sort of second area that we're seeing climate change happening. The third area is really around militant groups. And so militant groups such as Al-Shabaab and others, they're very good at providing a legitimate service in communities. And they've really done quite a big job on sort of stopping the illegal charcoal trade in areas they control. They've also done good work on stopping plastic bags. And so there is actually, and I guess that's sort of environmental security that people, communities need to provide and to be able to do livelihoods and have water and those things. Al-Shabaab or militant groups are doing quite good well at trying to control that. So that provides that sort of legitimacy as well. And that's what the state currently with international actors, we need to try to realize that we have to try to combat that and work in that area as well. That sort of area around militant groups. But we also recognize that Al-Shabaab and other groups do tax a lot of natural resources, so charcoal trade, sugar trade, those sort of things. So they actually get quite a lot of income from that. And also we think that there's a bit of income from water trucking and the taxation of water trucking during droughts. So how we look at humanitarian aid in that light, working around militant groups is really important. But basically different militant groups in this strand are taking control or recognizing climate change and the changes and using that to the advantage of providing legitimacy. So it's quite an interesting area that we're looking at as well. But yeah, they're the main things. But I think that really what we really need to recognize is that Somalia, based on the latest Adelphi Climate Weathering Risk Report, shows that by 2050, we're going to have 50% less water. And by 2080, we're going to have somewhere in the region of, I think it's a 5 to 6 degree rise in temperatures. And if we couple that with population increase, we could have by 2080, somewhere between 30 to 40 million people living in urban environments on the coastal areas because huge swathes of land will be unlivable. with that temperature rise. And if we look at the sporadic precipitation rainfall projections, coupled with soil erosion, deforestation, and increase in temperature, we're going to see there just won't be areas that people could live in or do agricultural land. So this means the risks of that are huge urbanization, lots of youth and young people not being able to have alternative livelihoods. So there'll be recruitment into militant groups will be much easier and rise of much more fundamentalism. And then we'll also have the risk of international migration and huge movement of populations into different areas that will be in search of alternative things. So we really need to recognize 2080 as this big sort of future, and that with the cycles of drought and flooding going to be happening more and more, we need to also change the theory around how do we focus on that.
Thanks, Christoph. And as you say, there is no direct causal link between climate change and security, but the connection between them, with climate as a further driver of conflicts and also exacerbating these insecurity dynamics, is quite clear. And more complex dynamics also that are not necessarily a clear cause and effect. For example, you just gave this example on illegal charcoal trade being both an issue that leads to this environmental degradation, deforestation, and also reduced resilience to climate change, but also increasing insecurity, the financing of armed opposition groups. So it's certainly a complex picture, not necessarily just cause and effect, but just one of your many very good examples. We know that the UN plays a big role in addressing the links between climate change, environments, and conflict that you just described, because it has specific mandates for each of these complex issues. Could you please explain what's the story behind the UN Security Council Resolution 2540, what the role is and why this is important?
Yeah, absolutely. The mandate given to UNSOM by the Security Council and comes up for renewal in May is really interesting. And UNSOM has one of the first, I believe, mandates that really focuses on climate change and climate risks. So it identifies the importance of analyzing and looking at climate risks. And it actually goes a bit further to talk about looking at what should we do about management of those risks. And this is really exciting because it really is one of the first. So the story behind it was that the Security Council started discussing this in about 2015, I think it was. And before that, previously, there's a lot of discussion around environmental security. But now we've moved into this sort of discussion around climate security and what does that mean for peacekeeping and peace operations. And that was when the Security Council started discussing that. And that's when they started the climate security mechanism, which brings together UNEP, UNDP, DPPA, and now I believe DPO is actually joining. And so then with that mechanism, it became the sort of Friends of Climate Security and the Security Council. And that's when the Security Council got together and started then discussing around mandates in peacekeeping and special political missions such as Somalia. And so it's really exciting that it's been recognized and that it continues through the Security Council to have several highlights and discussions. And unfortunately, the latest wider resolution in December was not passed, but it continues to gain pace. And I think more and more missions now have this sort of mandate. And what it means for us is that it really allows us to look at climate risks and to look at climate planning and looking at what does that mean and how do we really bring that into our programs and projects? How do we support the government? How do we really work across different agencies to look at mitigating some of these risks? And I think it's really important because too often we try to look at Somalia and fragile states from what they used to be and hoping that we could try to bring it back to that Barre regime where Somalia could export bananas. And the reality is much more grim if you look at the projections of climate risks and climate analysis. So what we need to do is use that to be able to identify and look at our programs and projects and make them more climate smart, climate resilient, but also really redirecting the humanitarian development and peace approaches to really trying to tweak those trends to 2080. And looking at those now, what do we need to do about that now? So it's incredibly important because it then allows us to have that mandate in the risk management. It allows to have people like me that can really bring that out to focus and coordinate work. And we can really focus on specific climate security approaches, which are much more coordinated and driven from a sort of really climate lens approach. So it's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, this resolution was an encouraging step, certainly. Let us look at the specific case of Somalia then to visualize what this looks like in practice. Because to fulfill its mandate, the UN in Somalia has embarked on a range of different activities and initiatives in the country, your role being one of them. Could you give us an overview of these activities? You already started touching upon them, but maybe something more specific, because many of them in Somalia were the first of its kind and also breaking a new ground in addressing climate security risks as part of the UN's engagement in a conflict-affected country.
Yeah. So basically what we tried to do, and we're in the process of trying to write a climate security strategy for the mission, but basically what we're trying to do is focus on three pillars. And one of them is really around peace building, where we are a special political mission in Somalia. We can only really advise and help on the coordination stuff. And the AU, the new ATMIS, or what it used to be called as AMISOM, were the ones actually doing the peacekeeping and have troops on the ground. But what we do is we try to advise the politics, the rule of law institutions, the economic development approaches, and the social development work. And my role as part of that is really trying to look at these three pillars of what we're trying to work in Somalia. But the first pillar is really around peace building. And when we talk about peace building, I tried to look at three sort of sub areas. One of them is looking at environmental mediation within stabilization programs. What does environmental mediation actually look like on the ground? It's like bringing different clans together, and we're trialing this at the moment. So bringing the clans together, looking at discussing climate change as the adversary, and then trying to figure out what do we do about that in terms of a climatic approach. And then there's a whole bit around working with communities around solutions, but much more from an ecosystem, nature-based solution approach. So trying to build that into a new mediation approach. The sort of second sub pillar of this peace building approach is to really look at mainstreaming climate and climate risks. And so what we do is we work with police, military, maritime authorities to think around climate change from a planning perspective. So looking at how do you incorporate climate change into planning and military operations? How do you look at understanding the militant or the armed grouped bit? I was talking about the pathways between climate and conflict and how militant groups are taking advantage of that and the use of natural resources. So there's quite a bit of work around that. And the sort of third pillar is looking at information and data. So we try to provide regular updates on climate risks. We try to disseminate and work with papers like the Delphi Weathering Risk Report and the CIPRI fact sheet. And the World Bank at the moment is trying to do a more in-depth climate security or vulnerability assessment, or a climate risk vulnerability assessment, which will look at the vulnerabilities of each of the different sectors to climate change. So what is education, health, and all those things. So those are the sort of things we're trying to do. So part of that is also doing training. So we do trainings to political mediation teams on climate sensitive conflict analysis. And we also try to provide analysis on conflicts based around climate change and trying to bring that climate lens into it, and specifically the competition of resources, and specifically looking at things like how do communal violence change based on climatic events, so water, flooding, droughts, and how they all lead to each other. So there's a big piece around that I will work on. The second pillar that we tried to work on is I'm part of the Deputy Special Representative's Office. So I have a mandate for sort of coordination as well. And so I tried to coordinate a bit around the extremities of water. So we have this National Task Force on Water Management led by the Ministry of Water. And then I tried to work with the interagency group, so all the different UN agencies and NGOs and communities, to try to look at the cyclical issues of flooding, droughts. And this is supposed to be a nexus approach. And when we talk about the nexus, it's really around bringing humanitarian development and peace actors together to try to find solutions from a short, medium, longer term approach. So what this means in practice is things like we've only really managed to focus on the flooding so far, where we've got coordination systems at the federal government, at the state level government, and at the community riverbed level. And what we're trying to do is then we work on breakage points along the river, and we work on things like, you know, sandbags for short term. We try to coordinate with the humanitarian actors. Then the sort of development actors will do in the medium term bank stabilization, and they'll do things like dams and those sort of things. And then we're trying to look at longer term solutions in terms of nature-based solutions. So we modeled out with various different organizations, including FAO and UNEP, looking at could we manage the floodplains much better? Could we increase the drainage system? Could we look at V-shaped weir dams? Could we look at sand dams? Different approaches that we can model out to say, if we did this and we rewilded these areas, we would be able to reduce the flooding by a significant amount. So that's the plan, is if we can really look at short, medium, long term, and then trying to bring those stabilization actors that are working on some areas that are insecure to work with humanitarians that are working with displaced populations, and then development actors that are looking at the sort of longer term funding and those things. So that's the sort of second bit. And part of that is also my role is also as the environmental advisor. I try to coordinate all UN agencies across the country on the environment, and I focus on trying to bring together different actors on the cooperation framework. And so that's the sort of second pillar of my work. And the third pillar is really around building a system. And so the government of Somalia in the office of the Prime Minister, it's called the Director of the Environment. And so they have the mandate for all things climate change. And so UNDP ourselves and different actors, we try to support the government on things like policy development. We try to support on strategic planning. We help and support them respond and work on the international commitments under the Paris Agreement. We support them and we work with them on things like the UNEA declarations. We work on various different international commitments that they have signed up for as well. But part of this is also around not just the policy side, but it's also the governance side. So we're also trying to work around environmental protection in terms of spill management. But we're also looking at things like wildlife trade, biodiversity loss. We're trying to look at prosecutions, legal systems building around that stuff. And then finally, we're trying to look at within this systems pillar is also how does the UN itself reduce its own footprint. With the AU, we have something like 30,000 troops on the ground, and that's a large amount of generators all pumping out quite a lot of fuel and oil and environmental issues. So we are trying to look at a public-private partnership and looking at mini-grids based in Baidoa. And if we could then build up that idea of changing over our power consumption that would then power also communities around and hopefully have an impact on some of the peace discussions and also would build the local economy. So there's quite a lot of options around that. So they're the sort of three pillars that I'm working.
Thanks so much for listening to you. I'm wondering if you and your team sleep at all. So many different aspects, but thanks for giving us an impression, because since you're the first UN security and environmental advisor to a country, that of course is super interesting to us, but also to our listeners. And I was wondering what have been your greatest achievements so far? And is this a role you deem useful for other UN missions as well? Listening to you, there is a lot of scope for action and also support and like having a meaningful role complementing other UN activities. Would you agree?
Yeah, exactly. My role is an advisor. It sounds a lot, but actually a lot of my work is very much around coordination and support. So we work very closely in collaboration with all the UN agencies. In terms of some of the successes, we see already quite a big shift in funding and programs approach. So we've just finished a really exciting program with FAO funded by the UK government on flood management. And so this is around providing sandbags, but it's also around bank stabilization, but it's also around this nature-based solutions. And so it's really exciting, some of the side of that. And we think that actually that work has led to, or it will lead to, the goo season that is coming now. And we don't think it will be as bad as we were expecting in terms of the rains. But if the rains are bad, time, then we think that we will have contributed quite significantly to the reduction of the impact of the flooding. So that should be a really exciting outcome for this. I think part of that is also the fact that we're really supported in coordination with peace actors as well as the humanitarian development actors. So we can really see bank work with community work, with FAO work. And so it's quite exciting. But I think just going on to other things, there's a lot of new programs. The IOM and UNEP have just started a new program on climate displacement. So looking at climate, what causes people to move because of climate change and what can you do about it? And so trying to find alternatives to reducing that cycle. And so that's really exciting. And we think that that's going to lead to some really exciting findings. UNDP are doing a really great piece of work on specific climate security at the community level. So working with Berghof Foundation, we're really looking at things like, how do you look at climate planning at the community level? And a lot of it is building on DRR work, but adding in that climate and the vulnerability, climate risks into that work. And so that is going to hopefully build some really exciting learnings from that as well. And so there's two big programs there. There's also this mediation program. I think that will be really exciting. And so hopefully that will lead to some really good work. And then there's some other work that we've been doing on displacement as well. So one of the other successes has been, we have worked with displaced sites or newly displaced sites. And we've been trying to make them much more environmentally sustainable. So looking at things like, if we were to rewild and grow trees in these areas and use these for charcoal and look at waste management and looking at soil health, looking at education, behavior change around the environmental impact on that side, we will hopefully have stopped that site from being flooded and having to displace again. So that's another exciting piece of work or result that we've seen. But I think also the main bit is that there's been a very big increase in funding and interest from donors. There's been a really great take up from the government of Somalia, which I think has been really great. And I think that there's also been some really training and awareness raising and work with communities to look at indigenous knowledges, work around adaptation mitigation to climate change that is really building a movement here. And then finally, the other thing is that we've just completed across UN and the government work around creating a youth platform around climate issues. And so that is really exciting where we can create this, because the youth of Somalia are really driving a lot of the new thinking around replanting trees and looking at rewilding areas and protection and those things. So it's really building on that energy and seeing what we can do about that. And then finally, the government of Somalia has been really great in terms of its work on policy level. So there's some great work around the National Environmental Strategic Action Plan, the National Adaptation Plan, the National Determined Contributions, the Environmental Management Act. So there's some really exciting policy level work that the federal government and the local member states are doing as well. And I think they answer that question around, is it important for other countries? I would say absolutely. I think that it's really important position, my type of position. And I would definitely recommend other ones. And I believe that there's an imminent start of someone in Sudan that would be funded. And I think that that's really quite exciting. And so building up that knowledge and that practice and trying to drive that together and learning from each other is going to be really great. But I think it's really important to provide that analysis to missions and to peacekeeping forces and to understand the impact and the scale and the vulnerabilities of climate change. So providing information, data, analysis is really important. But I also think this role is really important in terms of coordination. And so things like, how do you bring different actors together under the broad umbrella of climate change as well, environmental protection, I think is essential. And really people are seeing that, is that really both from the humanitarian perspective, we need to think around long-term sustainability. We can't go every year spending $1.4 billion in each of these countries on short-term plaster for saving people's lives. We've got to think around humanitarian responses that are linked to development or peacekeeping approaches that think around the environmental sustainability of it all, because it's only going to get worse. So we need to think outside of the box on that. And that's things like anticipatory funding. That's looking at how do we look at taking maybe certain parts of humanitarian funding to focus on rewilding and replanting it. But I think that that sort of coordination is really important. But I also think that the sort of project and program level, my sort of role really can help with delivering advice, support services to projects, communities, working with communities across the UN and different things around nature-based solutions. There's some really exciting work around, you know, what does climate security mean? And sort of the last bit of my role is around project and program delivery and really bringing in expertise around things like nature-based solutions, looking at ecosystems, health, thinking fresh water and the sort of technical responses to what we should be doing. So really changing again humanitarian development and peace actors to think around specifically things like, can we change the approach? Like boreholes, Somalia is completely littered by boreholes that have just not been successful. So what does that mean for really changing approaches, thinking around environmental sustainability, looking at the proper ecosystems, thinking around these things rather than focusing on a concrete traditional engineering approach? So advice and work on that is really important. So I would definitely recommend different missions having a position like this.
Thanks so much. Super interesting. And personally, of course, I completely agree with you. Taking it now to a rather general level, back to UN and UN politics, so to say. So in the UN, climate security is still having a hard time to be formally acknowledged as a topic of the UNSC. And we all remember, you already touched upon it, I think, last December when Ireland and Niger tabled a thematic resolution on systemically integrating climate-related security risks into the UN's conflict prevention, conflict management, and peacebuilding work, which was then vetoed by Russia. And where do you personally see things going? Do we need a thematic resolution, or are there maybe other ways around it? For example, by including climate security into other existing mandates, like in UNISOM.
I definitely see the relevance of the thematic resolution, and I think it would be good to keep pushing that. Although I think that with the reticence in the council by various members, I understand that that might be more complicated to do. But I think that as climate impacts get more and more visible, and they already are, like in Somalia, the drought or in the Horn of Africa, and with the wildfires and changes in temperatures and stuff like that in Europe and the floods in Germany last year, or whenever there was. But I think that there's a huge realization. And I think that as climate change becomes more and more real, hopefully there'll be more understanding and linkages. So I would definitely recommend that that should continue. I think the second bit is about having it in mandate. And I think that it's really important that peacekeeping and special political missions and other peace building approaches do have things in their mandate. And I think that I would even go further, because I think currently the discussion in the international community and discussion in think tanks around the world is that it's still looking at climate risks and looking at just the analysis of the risks. And I think we need to even go further to look at what do we do about it. And that's where I would like to see stronger wording in mandates that really look at things like, look at the climate. Nature-based solutions as approaches, I would look at environmental mediation, I'd look at coordinating nexus around environmental protection. I would look at something around mitigating and adaptation to climate change and putting those sort of things in mandate. And I think from then it allows the initiative for working across the different organizations and areas.
In light of the war in Ukraine and other crises around the world, do you agree that climate-related security is easily pushed aside as decision-makers feel the need to deal with more immediate matters? And if yes, what else can we do as a community to ensure that decision-makers understand that climate change impacts to security are part of the list of urgent issues to be dealt with immediately?
I think that I would agree. I think that with the war in Ukraine, I think that, and it does make sense that people focus on it because it's especially European communities and countries because it's so close by. So I understand that. However, I do think that there is probably an unbalanced approach to re-looking at funding and directing resources. Although it is a really important issue, I think that it just means that other conflicts that are around the world often do then get a reduction in funding, resources and support. So it just means that there's a slightly unfair linkage. And I think that even the sort of thorny issue around providing resources and support to refugees from Ukraine, as opposed to refugees from other crises around the world, in my own personal view, is something slightly biased. And so I think that there should be some review of it as well. But I think that Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, they has come into protracted crisis. It becomes complicated to keep people's attention as well as keeping funding going. However, I think that it's incredibly important. Afghanistan was a big learning for us all that you do need to really focus on climate and climate change as a central part of that. So there's quite a lot of reports coming out of Afghanistan to show that us as the international community focused quite a lot on central systems building and perhaps not enough on community resilience to climate change. And actually, that's where militant groups and different actors like the Taliban managed to take control and control over things. And that's what we're concerned about in Somalia and I think in different areas as well. So I think that really the importance of climate vulnerability and climate risks and looking at trying to mitigate and adapt against those and trying to mainstream climate change into programs is essential, especially as it gets worse and especially as droughts and humanitarian situations will happen. And I think that the international donors recognize the short-termness of the Ukraine war and what's happening there, short-term in terms of the 2080 sort of picture. And I think that people, specifically in other countries or in more developed countries, need to think around that there are these massive risks also in the sort of long term in terms of international migration, refugees. There's also increases in fundamentalism and militant groups. And I think that these sort of risks will come back if we don't really continue focusing on these and funding these and trying to look at specifically issues around that. And so that's where foreign offices, ministries of defense, different parts of governments really need to mainstream climate change, not only in their own governments, try to change the Paris agreements, but also need to continue funding in fragile states, which don't have the ability to really fight and adapt and mitigate. So I think it's really important. And you asked me what else we could do about it. And I think that there's a lot around private sector engagement. And I think that we need to totally rely on traditional donors approach. I think that there's the private sector. I think that there's Somali diaspora and the sort of funds that goes back and how that works. There's a huge opportunity there to really look at fighting and looking at climate change as a central part. So I think that there's options there. I think, the reality is that we spend a lot of time on the systems and the systems of governance. And actually, we really need to focus on the communities and the response to climate change as well.
Now, we spoke a lot about the UN and the UN system, but let us take a quick look at the international climate community. Because today, despite the importance and the relevance that climate security has for sustainable and peace-promoting climate negotiations, climate security is yet to become a formal part of the COP agenda. And this is mainly due to fears and misperceptions as to what it entails, especially in regards to security. Would you agree that looking at climate change with a human security lens legitimizes a discussion of climate security at COP, or could even create space for progress in that forum? And why would it be important, in your opinion, to include climate security more prominently at COP27 and beyond?
I would agree. I think that there is a lack of understanding. And I think still now today, there's a lack of a real clear definition around what climate security really is. And I think that to some extent, it's this human security, environment security, and it's somewhere in between there of looking at what climate security is. And it's much more future projections and looking at how do we bring that in to focus on it. And I think that the misconceptions around whether we should securitize climate change is the big fear. And I totally understand that. And that's the sort of thing we need to try to break down and realize that we have to work both within the security sectors, but also within the environmental sectors and the humanitarian development sectors. So these sort of things have to come together to really make a difference. And so I think absolutely we could focus, we should bring on the human security angle, but I also think that we should also bring in the sort of environmental security and the climate security together under the sort of drive of the human security to try to make sure that we don't miss out on some of those other aspects of work. So theoretically, yes, but I still think that we need to bring in the certain aspects of the other bits to look at that. And I think that it's important for COP27 to have something specifically on climate security, because otherwise COPs and the international approaches focus very much middle income and higher income countries. And the fragile states, the ones that are most impacted by climate change, they're the ones that actually bear the brunt. And so that's where there's often insecurity. So we have something like 8 out of the 10 peacekeeping forces around the world are in climate insecure countries. So there's a reason why there's insecurity in these countries. And a lot of it is to do with the fact that there's a massive competition over resources, this competition for water, land, grazing. And actually that's what climate security is about, is around understanding those links. And then the cycle between what people, I think, in the West or in Europe or in the US don't really gather is this issue between, unless we focus on fragile states and security, we're going to see increases in fundamentalism and militant groups, and we're going to see a big increase in refugees and displacement. And I think that's what we've got to realize, that sort of security, like you said, from a sort of human security angle, has to be brought in. And because COP27 is in Egypt and on the African continent, I would definitely urge that there is a big focus on this. I think the other angle to this is that there's now gaining momentum around the loss and damage discussion. I think climate security and loss and damage can make a sort of interesting partnership there around what does loss and damage, like, for example, in Somalia, what does climatic damage, what's the impact on that to the economy, to the growth, to the security, to the rule of law, to the politics, and how that's all together. And I think that looking at that sort of loss and damage approach as a central to that is really important. And so I think that then looking at loss and damage, climate security together would be an interesting area. I think the last bit is around financing, climate financing. I think the part of the problem is that climate financing, again, is very much based on more middle income or developed country approaches. And so GCF, GEF funding and a lot of the big climate financing is very complicated to get. And it's very difficult to really implement in fragile states because there's a lot of complexities around managing and delivering it. And it often can take 5 to 10 years, specifically in the GCF process. And what we need to do is think around funding that is much more for climate insecure countries and trying to look at climate security approaches that really try to strengthen the resilience of communities to those climate impacts. And then that will help with the insecurity side as well. So I think that looking at financing for less developed countries, or, and there are some funding, but I think that it's much more complicated and driven by a sort of different structures of governance and policies and work, rather than in fragile states where it's much more difficult to look at the policy level. It should be more at the community level. But yeah.
Thanks a lot, Chris. This was certainly a fascinating discussion, and I'm sure our listeners have a lot of food for thought, just like Raquel and I do. I will do my very best now to summarize the key aspects we spoke about today. We've learned from you that Somalia is a very beautiful country with driven people, but that clan dynamics became more important, as did extremist groups like Al-Shabaab. Despite some progress, militant groups are still controlling large parts of the country. This is also where the UN Special Political Mission comes in, trying to help with the political transition. And currently, Somalia is going through an election process, which hopefully leads to a recognized parliament and prime minister by summer. Now looking at climate change. Its implications are exacerbating some of the tensions and clan dynamics at play. Chris emphasized that there is no direct causal link between climate and conflict, but he sees on the ground how livelihoods are impacted, especially by the flood and drought cycle. Displacement is another big challenge. So people move due to climate events and use maladaptation techniques, for example, which means that displacement causes further displacement in a cycle of temperature rise, deforestation, and displacement, as he called it. Militant groups are doing well in providing livelihoods, which increases their legitimacy. The projected temperature rise most likely will lead to large parts of the country being uninhabitable. This is connected to other challenges such as urbanization, young people being recruited in military groups, and also the risk of international migration. UNSOM has one of the first mandates looking at climate risks, climate impacts, and also the management of these risks. It represents an example of how mandates should include climate security and peace building and keeping. Chris and his team use three entry points for their peace building work. First is environmental mediation, second, mainstreaming climate and climate risks, and third, distributing information and data as well as providing regular updates. Some of his successes include a noticeable shift in funding and project support. In his role, he brings different actors together from various fields, creating synergies between projects and supporting the dissemination of findings. For him, indigenous knowledge, including youth, and working around adaptation and mitigation is super important. Chris encourages us all to keep pushing for a thematic resolution in the UNSC and shared his thoughts about a shift from focus on governance to communities, which I personally find super interesting and a great idea to start with. He highlighted that environmental and climate security should be brought together under a human security angle. And he also thinks it is important for COP27 to have something specifically on climate security to better understand the links between fragile states, resource competition, migration, displacement, livelihoods, the environment, and human security. Finally, he also advocated for making climate funding easily accessible and less complicated, especially to insecure countries. This should also include approaches that strengthen resilience. I hope I did this comprehensive but super interesting interview justice. So thanks to our expert, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. So thank you very much. I really enjoyed the discussion. So thank you.
Thank you to our expert, Christoph Hodder, for joining us today and sharing his insights about climate security in Somalia and the role of the UN. It was a great pleasure talking to you. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. You can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Have a good day.
All right.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
See you soon. Have a great day. Bye.